This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents My Not-So-Perfect Life by Sophie Kinsella. Read for you by Fiona Hardingham. Part 1. Chapter 1. First, it could be worse. As commutes go, it could be a lot worse, and I must keep remembering this. Second, it's worth it. I want to live in London. I want to do this. And commuting is part of the deal. It's part of the London experience. Like Tate Modern. Actually, it's not much like Tate Modern. Bad example. My dad always says, if you can't run with the big dogs, stay under the porch. And I want to run with the big dogs. That's why I'm here. Anyway, my 20-minute walk to the station is fine. Enjoyable, even. The grey December air is like iron in my chest, but I feel good. The day's begun. I'm on my way. My coat's pretty warm, even though it cost £9.99 and came from the flea market. It had a label in it, Kristin Bior, but I cut it out as soon as I got home. You can't work where I work and have Kristin Bior in your coat. You could have a genuine vintage Christian Dior label, or something Japanese. Or maybe no label, because you make your clothes yourself out of retro fabrics that you source at Alfie's Antiques. But not Kristin Bior. As I get near Catford Bridge, I start to feel a knot of tension. I really don't want to be late today. My boss has started throwing all sorts of hissy fits about people, swanning in at all times. So I left an extra 20 minutes early, in case it was a bad day. I can already see. It's a god-awful day. They've been having a lot of problems on our line recently, and keep cancelling trains with no warning. Trouble is, in London rush hour, you can't just cancel trains. What are all the people who are planning to get on the train supposed to do? Evaporate? As I pass through the ticket barrier, I can already see the answer. They're crowded on the platform, squinting up at the information screen, jostling for position, peering down the line, scowling at one another, and ignoring one another, all at the same time. Oh, God! They must have cancelled at least 2 trains, because this looks like 3 trainloads of people, all waiting for the next one, clustered near the edge of the platform at strategic points. It's mid-December, but there's no Christmas spirit here. Everyone's too tense and cold, and Monday morning-ish. The only festive touch consists of a few miserable-looking fairy lights and a series of warning announcements about holiday transport. Screwing up my nerve, I join the throng and exhale in relief as a train pulls into the station. Not that I'll get on this train. Get on the first train! That would be ridiculous. There are people squashed up against the steamy windows, and as the doors slide open, only one woman gets off, looking pretty crumpled as she tries to extricate herself. But even so, the crowd surges forward, and somehow a load of people insert themselves inside the train, and it pulls away. And I'm that much farther forward on the platform. Now, I just have to keep my place and not let that scrawny guy with gelled hair edge in front of me. I've taken out my earbuds so I can listen for announcements and stay poised and vigilant. Commuting in London is basically warfare. It's a constant campaign of claiming territory, inching forward, never relaxing for a moment. Because if you do, someone will step past you, or step on you. Exactly 11 minutes later, the next train pulls in. I head forward with the crowd, trying to block out the soundtrack of angry exclamations. Can you move down? There's room inside. They just need to move down. I've noticed that people inside trains have completely different expressions from people on platforms, especially the ones who have managed to get a seat. They're the ones who got over the mountains to Switzerland. They won't even look up. They maintain this guilty, defiant refusal to engage. I know you're out there. I know it's awful, and I'm safe inside, but I suffered too. So let me just read my Kindle without bloody guilt-tripping me, okay? People are pushing and pushing, and someone's actually shoving me. I can feel fingers on my back. and suddenly I'm stepping onto the train floor. Now I need to grab onto a pole or a handle, anything, and use it as leverage. Once your foot's on the train, you're in. A man way behind me seems very angry. I can hear extra loud shouting and cursing. And suddenly, there's a groundswell behind me, like a tsunami of people. I've only experienced this a couple of times, and it's terrifying. I'm being pushed forward without even touching the ground, and as the train doors close, I end up squeezed between two guys, one in a suit and one in a tracksuit, and a girl eating a panini. We're so tightly wedged that she's holding her panini about 3 inches away from my face. Every time she takes a bite, I get a waft of pesto. But I studiously ignore it. And the girl. And the men. Even though I can feel the tracksuit guy's warm thigh against mine and count the stubbly hairs on his neck. As the train starts moving, we're constantly bumped against one another. But no one even makes eye contact. I think if you make eye contact on the tube, they call the police or something. To distract myself, I try to plan the rest of my journey. When I get to Waterloo East, I'll check out which tube line is running best. I can do Jubilee District, takes ages, or Jubilee Central, longer walk at the other end, or Overground, even longer walk at the other end. And yes, if I'd known I was going to end up working in Chiswick, I wouldn't have chosen to rent in Catford. But when I first came to London, it was to do an internship in East London. They called it Shoreditch in the ad. It so wasn't Shoreditch. Catford was cheap, and it wasn't too far. And now I just can't face West London prices, and the commute's not that bad. Ah! I shriek as the train jolts, and I'm thrown violently forward. The girl has been thrown too, and her hand shoots up toward my face, and before I know it, my open mouth has landed on the end of her panini. What? I'm so shocked. I can't react. My mouth is full of warm, doughy bread and melted mozzarella. How did this even happen? Instinctively, my teeth clench shut, a move I immediately regret. Although, what else was I supposed to do? Nervously, I raise my eyes to hers, my mouth still full. Sorry, I mumble, but it comes out. Obli. What the fuck? The girl addresses the carriage incredulously. She's stealing my breakfast! My head's sweating with stress. This is bad. Bad. What do I do now? Bite off the panini? Not good. Just let it fall out of my mouth. Even worse, ugh. There's no good way out of this situation. None. At last, I bite fully through the panini, my face burning with embarrassment. Now I have to chew my way through a mouthful of someone else's claggy bread, with everyone watching. I'm really sorry, I say awkwardly to the girl, as soon as I've managed to swallow. I hope you enjoy the rest. I don't want it now, she glares at me. It's got your germs on it. Well, I don't want your germs either. It wasn't my fault, I fell on it. You fell on it, she echoes, so skeptically that I stare at her. Yes, of course. I mean, what do you think? That I did that on purpose? Who knows? She puts a protective hand around the rest of her panini, as though I might launch myself at her and bite another chunk off. All kinds of weird people in London. I'm not weird. You can fall on me any time, love, puts in the guy in the tracksuit with a smirk. Only don't chew, he adds, and laughter comes from all around the carriage. My face flames even redder, but I'm not going to react. In fact, this conversation is over. For the next 15 minutes, I gaze sternly ahead, trying to exist in my own little bubble. At Waterloo East, we all disgorge from the train, and I breathe in the cold, fumy air with relief. I stride as quickly as I can to the underground, opt for Jubilee District, and join the crowd round the door. As I do so, I glance at my watch and quell a sigh. I've been travelling for 45 minutes already, and I'm not even nearly there. As someone steps on my foot with a stiletto, I have a sudden flashback to Dad pushing open our kitchen door, stepping outside, spreading his arms wide to take in the view of fields and endless sky, and saying, "Shortest commute in the world, darling. Shortest commute in the world." When I was little, I had no idea what he meant. But now, "Move down! Will you move down?" A man beside me on the platform is yelling so loudly I flinch. The underground train has arrived, and there's the usual battle between the people inside the carriage, who think it's totally crammed, and the people outside, who are measuring the empty spaces with forensic, practice eyes, and reckon you could fit another 20 people in. Easy. Finally, I get on the tube and fight my way off at Westminster and wait for the district line, then chug along to Turnham Green. As I get out at the tube station, I glance at my watch and start running. Shit. I barely have 10 minutes. Our office is a large, pale building called Fillmore House. As I get near, I slow to a walk, my heart still pounding. My left heel has a massive blister on it, but the main thing is, I've made it. I'm on time. Magically, there's a lift waiting, and I step in, trying to smooth down my hair, which flew in all directions as I was pegging it down Chiswick High Road. The whole commute took 1 hour and 20 minutes in all, which actually could be worse. "Wait!" An imperious voice makes me freeze. Across the lobby is striding a familiar figure. She has long legs, high-heeled boots, expensive highlights, a biker jacket, and a short skirt in an orange textured fabric which makes every other garment in the lift look suddenly old and obvious. Especially my £8.99 black jersey skirt. She has amazing eyebrows. Some people are just granted amazing eyebrows, and she's one of them. "Horrendous journey," she says as she gets into the lift. Her voice is husky, coppery, grown-up sounding. It's a voice that knows stuff, that doesn't have time for fools. She jabs the floor number with a manicured finger, and we start to rise. "Absolutely horrendous," she reiterates. "The lights would not change at the Chiswick Lane Junction. It took me 25 minutes to get here from home. 25 minutes! She gives me one of her swooping, eagle-like gazes, and I realize she's waiting for a response. "Oh," I say feebly. "Poor you." The lift doors open and she strides out. A moment later, I follow, watching her haircut fall perfectly back into shape with every step, and breathing in that distinctive scent she wears, bespoke, created for her at Annick Goutal in Paris on her 5th wedding anniversary trip. This is my boss. This is Demeter, the woman with the perfect life. I'm not exaggerating. When I say Demeter has the perfect life, believe me, it's true. Everything you could want out of life, she has. Job, family, general coolness, tick, tick, tick. Even her name. It's so distinctive. She doesn't need to bother with her surname, Farlow. She's just Demeter. Like Madonna. "Hi," I'll hear her saying on the phone in that confident, louder-than-average voice of hers. "It's Demeter." She's 45, and she's been executive creative director at Cooper Clemo for just over a year. Cooper Clemo is a branding and strategy agency, and we have some pretty big clients. Therefore, Demeter's a pretty big deal. Her office is full of awards and framed photos of her with illustrious people and displays of products she's helped to brand. She's tall and slim and has shiny brunette hair and, as I already mentioned, amazing eyebrows. I don't know what she earns, but she lives in Shepherd's Bush, in this stunning house, which apparently she paid over $2 million for, my friend Flora told me. Flora also told me that Demeter had her sitting room floor imported from France, and it's reclaimed oak parquet and cost a fortune. Flora's the closest in rank to me. She's a creative associate, and she's a constant source of gossip about Demeter. I even went to look at Demeter's house once, not because I'm a sad stalker, but because I happened to be in the area, and I knew the address, and, You know, why not check out your boss's house if you get the chance? Okay, full disclosure, I only knew the street name. I googled the number of the house when I got there. Of course, it's heart-achingly tasteful. It looks like a house in a magazine. It is a house in a magazine. It's been profiled in Living, etc., with Demeter standing in her all-white kitchen, looking elegant and creative in a retro print top. I stood and stared at it for a while. Not exactly lusting. It was more wistful than that. Wisting. The front door is a gorgeous grey-green, farrow and ball, or little green, I'm sure, with an old-looking lion's head knocker and elegant pale grey stone steps leading up to it. The rest of the house is pretty impressive, too. All painted window frames and slatted blinds, and a glimpse of a wooden treehouse in the back garden. But it was the front door that mesmerized me. And the steps. Imagine having a set of beautiful stone steps to descend every day like a princess in a fairy tale. You'd start every morning off feeling fabulous. Two cars on the front forecourt, a grey Audi and a black Volvo SUV, all shiny and new. Everything Demeter has is either shiny and new and on trend, designer juicy machine, or old and authentic and on trend, huge antique wooden necklace that she got in South Africa. I think authentic might be Demeter's favourite word in the whole world. She uses it about 30 times a day. Demeter is married, of course. And she has two children, of course. A boy called Hal and a girl called Coco. She has zillions of friends she's known forever and is always going to parties and events and design awards. Sometimes she'll sigh and say it's her third night out that week and exclaim, "Glutton for punishment," as she changes into her Miu Miu shoes. I take quite a lot of her Net-a-Porter packaging to recycling for her, so I know what labels she wears. Miu Miu. Marnie in the sale, Dries Van Noten, also quite a lot of Zara. But then, as she's heading out, her eyes will start sparkling, and the next thing, the photos are all over Cooper Clemo's Facebook page and Twitter account, and everywhere. Demeter, in a cool black top, probably Hermit Lang, she likes him too, holding a wine glass and beaming with famous designer types, and being perfect. And here's the thing. I'm not envious. Not exactly. I don't want to be Demeter. I don't want her things. I mean, I'm only 26. What would I do with a Volvo SUV? But when I look at her, I feel this pinprick of something. And I think, could that be me? Could that ever be me? When I've earned it, could I have Demeter's life? It's not just the things, but the confidence, the style, the sophistication, the connections. If it took me 20 years, I wouldn't mind. In fact, I'd be ecstatic. If you told me, guess what, if you work hard in 20 years' time, you'll be leading that life. I'd put my head down right now and get to it. It's impossible, though. It could never happen. People talk about ladders and career structures and rising through the ranks. But I can't see any ladder leading me to Demeter's life, however hard I work. I mean, £2 million. For a house. £2 million. I worked it out once. Just suppose a bank ever lent me that kind of money, which they wouldn't. On my current salary, it would take me 193.4 years to pay it off. And, you know, live. When that number appeared on my calculator screen, I actually laughed out loud, a bit hysterically. People talk about the generation gap. Generation chasm, more like. Generation Grand Canyon. There isn't any ladder big enough to stretch from my place in life to Demeter's place in life. Not without something extraordinary happening, like the lottery, or rich parents, or some genius website idea that makes my fortune. Don't think I'm not trying. I spend every night attempting to invent a new kind of bra or low-calorie caramel. No joy yet. So anyway, I can't aim for Demeter's life, not exactly. But I can aim for some of it, the achievable bits. I can watch her, study her. I can learn how to be like her. And also, crucially, I can learn how to be not like her. Because, didn't I mention? She's a nightmare. She's perfect, and she's a nightmare. Both. I'm just powering up my computer when Demeter comes striding into our open-plan office, sipping her soy latte. People, she says, people, listen up. This is another of Demeter's favorite words, people. She comes into our space and says, people, in that drama school voice, and we all have to stop what we're doing as though there's going to be an important group announcement, when, in fact, what she wants is something very specific that only one person knows. But since she can barely remember which of us does what, or even what our names are, she has to ask everyone. All right, this is a slight exaggeration, but not much. I've never met anyone as terrible at remembering names as Demeter. Flora told me once that Demeter actually has a real visual problem, some facial recognition thing, but she won't admit it, because she reckons it doesn't affect her ability to do her job. Well, newsflash, it does. And second newsflash, what does facial recognition have to do with remembering a name properly? I've been here 7 months, and I swear she's still not sure whether I'm Kath or Cat. I'm Cat, in fact. Cat, short for Catherine, because, well, it's a cool nickname. It's short and punchy. It's modern. It's London. It's me, Cat. Cat Brenner. Hi, I'm Cat. Hi, I'm Catherine, but call me Cat. Okay, full disclosure. It's not absolutely me. Not yet. I'm still part Katie. I've been calling myself Kat since I started this job, but for some reason it hasn't fully taken. Sometimes I don't respond as quickly as I should when people call out, Kat! I hesitate before I sign it. And one hideous time, I had to scrub out a K. I'd started writing on one of those big office birthday cards. Luckily no one saw. I mean, who doesn't know their own name? But I'm determined to be Kat. I will be Kat. It's my all-new London name. I've had 3 jobs in my life. Okay, 2 were internships. And at each new step, I've reinvented myself a bit more. Changing from Katie to Kat is just the latest stage. Katie is the home me. The Somerset me. A rosy-cheeked, curly-haired country girl who lives in jeans and wellies and a fleece which came free with the delivery of sheep food. A girl whose entire social life is the local pub, or maybe the Ritzy in Warriton. A girl I've left behind. As long as I can remember, I've wanted out of Somerset. I've wanted London. I've never had boy bands on my bedroom wall. I had the tube map, posters of the London Eye and the Gherkin. The first internship I managed to scrape was in Birmingham. And that's a big city too. It's got the shops, the glamour, the buzz. But it's not London. It doesn't have that Londonness that makes my heart soar. The skyline, the history, walking past Big Ben and hearing it chime in real life. Standing in the same tube stations that you've seen in a million films about the Blitz. Feeling that you're in one of the best cities in the world, no question, hands down. Living in London is like living in a movie set. From the Dickensian back streets to the glinting tower blocks, to the secret garden squares. You can be anyone you want to be. There's not much in my life that would score in the top 10 of any global survey. I don't have a top 10 job, or wardrobe, or flat. But I live in a top 10 city. Living in London is something that people all over the world would love to do. And now I'm here. And that's why I don't care if my commute is the journey from hell, and I don't care if my bedroom is about 3 foot square. I'm here. I couldn't get here straight away. The only offer I had after uni was in a tiny marketing firm in Birmingham. So I moved up there and immediately started creating a new personality. I had bangs cut. I started straightening my hair every day and putting it in a smart knot. I bought myself a pair of black glasses with clear lenses. I looked different. I felt different. I even started doing my makeup differently, with super-defined lip liner every day and black liquid eyeliner in flicky curves. It took me a whole weekend to learn how to do that flicky eyeliner. It's an actual skill, like trigonometry. So what I wonder is, why don't they teach that at school? If I ran the country, there'd be courses and things that you'd actually use your whole life, like how to do eyeliner, how to fill in a tax return, what to do when your loo blocks and your dad isn't answering the phone and you're about to have a party. It was in Birmingham that I decided to lose my West Country accent. I was in the loo, minding my own business, when I heard a couple of girls taking the piss out of me. "Farmer Katie," they were calling me. And yes, I was shocked, and yes, it stung. I could have burst out of my cubicle and exclaimed, "Well, I don't think your Brummy accent's any better." But I didn't. I just sat there and thought hard. It was a reality check. By the time I got my second internship, the one in East London, I was a different person. I'd wised up. I didn't look or sound like Katie Brenner from Anster's Farm. And now, I'm totally Kat Brenner from London. Kat Brenner, who works in a cool office with distressed brick walls and white shiny desks and funky chairs and a coat stand in the shape of a naked man. It gives everyone a real shock the first time they come to visit. I mean, I am Kat. I will be. I just have to nail that not signing the wrong names thing. "People," Demeter says for a third time, and the office becomes quiet. There are 10 of us in here, all with different titles and job descriptions. On the next floor up, there's an events team and a digital team and the planning lot. There's also some other group of creatives called the Vision Team, who work directly with Adrian, the CEO, plus other offices for talent management and finance or whatever. But this floor is my world, and I'm at the bottom of the pile. I earn by far the least, and my desk is the smallest, but you have to start somewhere. This is my first ever paid job, and I thank my lucky stars for it every day. And, you know, my work is interesting. In a way. Kind of. I mean, I suppose it depends how you define interesting. I'm currently working on this really exciting project to launch a new self-foaming, cappuccino-style creamer from Coffee White. I'm on the research side, and what that actually comes down to in terms of my day-to-day work is... Well, here's the thing. You have to be realistic. You can't go straight in at the fun, glam stuff. Dad just doesn't get that. He's always asking, "Do I come up with all the ideas? Or have I met lots of important people? Or do I go for swanky business lunches every day?" Which is ridiculous. And yes, I'm probably defensive, but he doesn't understand, and it really doesn't help when he starts wincing and shaking his head and saying, "And you're really happy in the big smoke, Katie, my love?" I am happy. But that doesn't mean it's not hard. Dad doesn't know anything about jobs, or London, or the economy, or, I don't know, the price of a glass of wine in a London bar. I haven't even told him exactly how much my rent is, because I know what he'd say. He'd say, "Oh God, deep breath. Sorry, I didn't mean to launch into some off-topic rant about my dad. Things haven't been great between us ever since I moved away after uni. He doesn't understand why I moved here. And he never will." And I can try to explain it all I like. But if you can't feel London, all you see are traffic and fumes and expense, and your daughter choosing to move more than 100 miles away. I had a choice. Follow my heart, or don't break his. I think in the end I broke a bit of both our hearts, which the rest of the world doesn't understand, because they think it's normal to move out and away from home. But they aren't my dad and me, who live together, just us, for all those years. Anyway, back to my work. People at my level don't meet the clients. Demeter does that. And Rosa. They go out for the lunches and come back with pink cheeks and free samples and excitement. Then they put together a pitch, which usually involves Mark and Liz too, and someone from the digital team, and sometimes Adrian. He's not just CEO, but also the co-founder of Cooper Clemo. And he has an office downstairs. There was another co-founder called Max, but he retired early to the south of France. Adrian's quite amazing, actually. He's about 50 and has a shock of iron grey, wavy hair and wears a lot of denim shirts and looks like he comes from the 70s, which I suppose in a way he does. He's also properly famous, like there's a display of alumni outside King's College London on the Strand and Adrian's picture is up there. Anyway, so that's all the main players. But I'm not at that level. Nothing like. As I said, I'm involved in the research side, which means what I'm actually doing this week is... And listen, before I say it, it doesn't sound glamorous, okay? But it's not as bad as it sounds. Really. I'm inputting data. To be specific, the results of this big customer survey we did for Coffee White about coffee, creamers, cappuccinos and, well, everything. 2,000 handwritten surveys, each 8 pages long. I know, right? Paper. No one does paper surveys anymore. But Demeter wanted to go old school because she read some research that said people are 25% more honest when they're writing with a pen than they are online. Or something. So here we are. Or rather, here I am, with 5 boxfuls of questionnaires still to go. It can get a bit tiring, because it's the same old questions, and the participants all scribbled their answers in biro, and they aren't always clear. But on the plus side, this research will shape the whole project. Flora was all, "My God, poor you, Kat! What a bloody nightmare!" But actually, it's fascinating. Well, I mean, you have to make it fascinating. I've taken to guessing people's income brackets based on what they said in the question about foam density. And you know what? I'm usually right. It's like mind reading. The more I'm inputting these answers, the more I'm learning about consumers. At least, I hope so. People, what the fuck is up with Trekbix? Demeter's voice breaks into my thoughts again. She's standing in her spiky heels, thrusting a hand through her hair with that impatient, frustrated, what-is-wrong-with-the-world expression she gets. I wrote myself a set of notes about this. She's scrolling through her phone, ignoring us all again. I know I did. I haven't seen any notes, says Sarah from behind her desk, using her customary low, discreet voice. Saint Sarah, as Flora calls her. Sarah is Demeter's assistant. She has luscious red hair, which she ties into a ponytail, and very white, pretty teeth. She's the one who makes her own clothes, gorgeous retro 50s-style outfits with circular skirts. And how she keeps sane, I have no idea. Demeter has got to be the scattiest person in the universe. Every day, it seems, she misplaces a document or gets the time of an appointment wrong. Sarah is always very patient and polite to Demeter, but you can see her frustration in her mouth. It goes all tight and one corner disappears into her cheek. She's apparently the master of sending emails out from Demeter's account, in Demeter's voice, saving the situation, apologizing and generally smoothing things over. I know it's a big job that Demeter does. Plus, she has her family to think about and school concerts or whatever. But how can you be this flaky? Right, found it. Why was it in my personal folder? Demeter looks up from her phone with that confused, eye-darty look she sometimes gets, like the entire world confounds her. You just need to save it under... Sarah tries to take Demeter's phone, but she swipes it away. I know how to use my phone. That's not the point. The point is... She stops dead, and we all wait breathlessly. This is another Demeter habit. She starts a really arresting sentence and then stops halfway through, as though her batteries have been turned off. I glance at Flora, and she does a little eye roll to the ceiling. Yes, yes, Demeter resumes. What's going on with Trekbix? Because I thought Liz was going to write a response to their email, but I've just had a further email from Rob Kincaid asking why he's heard nothing. So? She swivels around to Liz, finally focusing on the person she needs to, finally coming alive. Liz, where is it? You promised me a draft by this morning. She taps her phone. It's in my notes from last Monday's meeting. Liz to write draft. First rule of client care, Liz. Hold the client's hand, I think to myself, although I don't say it out loud. That would be too geeky. Hold the client's hand, declaims Demeter. Hold it throughout. Make them feel secure every minute of the process. Then you'll have a happy customer. You're not holding Rob Kincaid's hand, Liz. His hand's dangling, and he's not a happy bunny. Liz colours. I'm still working on it. Still? There's a lot to put in. Well, work faster, Demeter frowns at her. And send it to me for approval first. Don't just ping it off to Rob. By lunchtime, okay? Okay, mumbles Liz, looking pissed off. She doesn't often put a foot wrong, Liz. She's project manager and has a very tidy desk and straight fair hair, which she washes every day with apple-scented shampoo. She eats a lot of apples, too. Actually, I've never connected those two facts before. Weird. Where is that email from Rob Kincaid? Demeter is scrolling back and forth, peering at her phone. It's disappeared from my inbox. Have you deleted it by mistake? Says Sarah patiently. I'll forward it to you again. This is Sarah's other pet annoyance. Demeter is always carelessly deleting emails and then needing them urgently and getting in a tiz. Sarah says she spends half her life forwarding emails to Demeter, and thank God one of them has an efficient filing system. There you are, Sarah clicks briskly. I forwarded Rob's email to you. In fact, I've forwarded all his emails to you, just in case. Thanks, Sarah, Demeter subsides. I don't know where that email went. She's peering at her phone, but Sarah doesn't seem interested. So, Demeter, I'm going off to my first aid training now, she says, reaching for her bag. I told you about it, because I'm the first aid officer. Right, Demeter looks bemused, and it's clear she'd totally forgotten. Great! Well done, you. So, Sarah, before you go, let's touch base. She scrolls through her phone. It's the London Food Awards tonight. I need to get to the hairdressers this afternoon. You can't, Sarah interrupts. This afternoon is solid. What? Demeter looks up from her phone. But I booked the hairdressers. For tomorrow. Tomorrow? Demeter sounds aghast and her eyes are swiveling again. No, I booked it for Monday. Look at your calendar. Sarah sounds barely able to control her patience. It was Tuesday, Demeter. Always Tuesday. But I need my roots done, urgently. Can I cancel anyone this afternoon? It's those Polenta people, and then it's the team from Green Teen. Shit! Demeter screws up her face in agony. Shit! And you've got a conference call in 15 minutes. Can I go? Says Sarah in long-suffering tones. Yes, yes, you go! Demeter waves a hand. Thanks, Sarah! She heads back into her glass-walled office, exhaling sharply. Shit! Shit! Oh, she reappears. Rosa, the Sensiquo logo. We should try it in a bigger point size. It came to me on my way in. And try the roundel in aquamarine. Can you talk to Mark? Where is Mark? She glances querulously at his desk. Working from home today, says John, a junior creative. Oh, says Demeter mistrustfully. Okay. Demeter doesn't really believe in working from home. She says you lose the flow with people disappearing the whole time. But Mark had it negotiated into his contract before Demeter arrived, so there's nothing she can do about it. Don't worry, I'll tell him, says Rosa, scribbling furiously on her notepad. Point size, aquamarine. Great. Oh, and Rosa, she pops her head out yet again. I want to discuss Python training. Everyone in this office should be able to code. What? Coding, says Demeter impatiently. I read a piece about it in the Huffington Post. Put it on the agenda for the next group meeting. Okay, Rosa looks baffled. Coding. Fine. As Demeter closes her door, everyone breathes out. This is Demeter. Totally random. Keeping up with her is exhausting. Rosa is tapping frantically at her phone, and I know she's sending a bitchy text about Demeter to Liz. Sure enough, a moment later, Liz's phone pings, and she nods vociferously at Rosa. I haven't totally fathomed the office politics of this place. It's like trying to catch up on a TV soap opera mid-flow. But I do know that Rosa applied for Demeter's job and didn't get it. I also know that they had a massive row just before I arrived. Rosa wanted to get on some big one-off special project that the Mayor of London spearheaded. It was branding some new London athletics event, and he put together a team seconded from creative agencies all over London. The Evening Standard called it a showcase for London's best and brightest. But Demeter wouldn't let Rosa do it. She said she needed Rosa on her team 24/7, which was bullshit. Since then, Rosa has hated Demeter with a passion. Flora's theory is that Demeter's so paranoid about being overtaken by her young staff that she won't help anyone. If you even try to climb the ladder, she stamps on your fingers with her Miu Miu shoes. Apparently, Rosa's desperate to leave Cooper Clemo now. But there's not a lot out there in this market. So here, poor Rosa stays, stuck with a boss she hates, basically loathing every moment of her work. You can see it in her hunched shoulders and frowning brow. Mark also loathes Demeter, and I know the story there too. Demeter's supposed to oversee the design team. Oversee, not do it all herself. But she can't stop herself. Design is Demeter's thing, design and packaging. She knows the names of more typefaces than you can imagine, and sometimes she interrupts a meeting just to show us all some packaging design that she thinks really works, which is, you know, great. But it's also a problem because she's always wading in. So last year, Cooper Clemo refreshed the branding of a big moisturizer called Drench, and it was Demeter's idea to go pale orange with white type. Well, it's been this massive hit, and we've won all sorts of prizes. All good, except for Mark, who's head of design. Apparently, he'd already created this whole other design package, but Demeter came up with the orange idea, mocked it up herself, and flung it out there at a client meeting. And apparently, Mark felt totally belittled. The worst thing is, Demeter didn't even notice that Mark was pissed off. She doesn't pick up on things like that. She's all, high five, great work team, move on, next project. And then it was such a huge hit that Mark could hardly complain. I mean, in some ways, he's lucky. He got a load of credit for that redesign. He can put it on his CV and everything. But still, he's all bristly and has this sarcastic way of talking to Demeter, which makes me wince. The sad thing is, everyone else in the office knows Mark is really talented. Like, he's just won the Style Sign Award for innovation. Apparently it's some really prestigious thing. But it's as if Demeter doesn't even realize what a great head of design she has. Liz isn't that happy here either, but she puts up with it. Flora, on the other hand, bitches about Demeter all the time. But I think that's because she loves bitching. I'm not sure about the others. As for me, I'm still the new girl. I've only been here 7 months, and I keep my head down and don't venture my opinion too much. But I do have ambition. I do have ideas. I'm all about design too, especially typography. In fact, that's what Demeter and I talked about in my interview. Whenever a new project comes into the office, my brain fires up. I've put together so many bits of spec work in my spare time on my laptop. Logos, design concepts, strategy documents. I keep emailing them to Demeter for feedback, and she keeps promising she will look at them when she has a moment. Everyone says you mustn't chivy Demeter, or she flies off the handle. So I'm biding my time, like a surfer waiting for a wave. I'm pretty good at surfing, as it happens, and I know the wave will come. When the moment is right, I'll get Demeter's attention. She'll look at my stuff, everything will click, and I'll start riding my life. Not paddling, 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 like I am right now. I'm just picking up my next survey from the pile when Hannah, another of our designers, enters the office. There's a general gasp and Flora turns to raise her eyebrows at me. Poor Hannah had to go home on Friday. She really wasn't well. She's had about 5 miscarriages over the last 2 years, and it's left her a bit vulnerable. And occasionally, she has a panic attack. It happened Friday, so Rosa told her to go home and have a rest. The truth is, Hannah works probably the hardest in the office. I've seen emails from her at 2 a.m. She deserves a bit of a break. Hannah! Rosa exclaims. Are you okay? Take it really easy today. I'm fine, says Hannah, slipping into her seat, avoiding everyone's eye. I'm fine. She instantly opens up a document and starts work, sipping from a bottle of filtered tap water. Cooper Clemo launched the brand, so we all have these freebie neon bottles on our desks. Hannah! Demeter appears at the door of her office. You're back. Well done. I'm fine, says Hannah yet again. I can tell she doesn't want any fuss made, but Demeter comes right over to her desk. Now, please, don't worry, Hannah, she says in her ringing, authoritative tones. No one thinks you're a drama queen or anything like that, so don't worry about it at all. She gives Hannah a friendly nod, then strides back into her office and shuts her door. The rest of us are watching, dumbstruck, and poor Hannah looks absolutely stricken. As soon as Demeter is back in her office, she turns to Rosa. Do you all think I'm a drama queen? She gulps. No! Exclaims Rosa at once, and I can hear Liz muttering, Bloody Demeter. Listen, Hannah, Rosa continues, heading to Hannah's desk, crouching down and looking her straight in the eye. You've just been Demetered. That's right, agrees Liz. You've been Demetered. It happens to us all. She's an insensitive cow, and she says stupid stuff, and you just have to not listen, okay? You've done really well coming in today, and we all really appreciate the effort you've made, don't we? She looks around, and a spatter of applause breaks out, whereupon Hannah's cheeks flush with pleasure. Fuck Demeter, ends Rosa succinctly, and she heads back to her desk amid even more applause. From the corner of my eye, I can see Demeter glancing out of her glass-walled office, as though wondering what's going on, and I almost feel sorry for her. She really has no idea. Chapter 2 For the next hour or so, everyone works peacefully. Demeter is on her conference call in her office, and I get through a stack of surveys, and Rosa passes round a bottle of retro sweets. And I'm just wondering what time I'll break for lunch, when Demeter sticks her head out of her door again. I need... Her eyes roam around the office and eventually land on me. You. What are you doing right now? Me? I feel a jolt of surprise. Nothing. I mean, I'm working. I mean, could you bear to come and help me out with something? A bit... She gives one of her Demeter pauses. Different? Yes, I say, trying not to sound flustered. Sure. Of course. In 5 minutes, okay? 5 minutes, I nod. Absolutely. I turn back to my work, but the words are blurring in front of my eyes. My head is spinning in excitement. Something a bit different. That could be anything. It could be a new client, a website, a revolutionary branding concept that Demeter wants to pioneer. Whatever it is, it's my chance. This is my wave. There's a joyful swell in my chest. All those emails I've been sending her weren't for nothing. She must have been looking at my ideas all along, and she thinks I've got potential, and she's been waiting for the most perfect, special project. My hands are actually trembling as I get out my laptop, plus a few printouts in a portfolio that I keep in my drawer. There's no harm in showing her my most recent work, is there? I reapply my lipstick and spray on some perfume. I need to look sharp and together. I need to nail this. After exactly 4.5 minutes, I push back my chair, feeling self-conscious. Here we go. The waves cresting, my heart's thudding, and everything around me feels a bit brighter than usual. But as I thread my way through all the desks to Demeter's door, I try to appear nonchalant. Cool, like, yeah, Demeter and I just having a one-to-one. We're going to bounce some ideas around. Oh my God, what if it's something huge? I have a sudden image of Demeter and me staying late in the office, eating Chinese takeout, working on some amazing, groundbreaking project. Perhaps I'd do a presentation. I can tell Dad about this. Maybe I'll call him tonight. Hi. I tap at Demeter's door and push it ajar. Calf, she exclaims. Actually, it's Cat, I venture. Of course, Cat. Marvellous. Come in. Now, I hope you don't mind me asking you this. Of course not, I say quickly. Whatever it is, I'm up for it. Obviously my background's design, but I'm really interested in corporate identity, strategy, digital opportunities, whatever. Now I'm rambling. Stop it, Katie. Shit, I mean, stop it, Cat. I'm Cat! Right, says Demeter absently, typing the end of an email. She sends it off, then turns and eyes my laptop and portfolio with surprise. What's all that for? Oh, I colour and shift the portfolio awkwardly. I brought a few things. Some ideas. Well, put it down somewhere, says Demeter without interest, and starts rootling in her desk drawer. Now, I hate to ask you this, but I'm absolutely desperate. My diary is a nightmare, and I've got these wretched awards this evening. I mean, I can get myself to a blow-dry bar, but my roots are a different matter, so I'm not quite following what she's saying, but the next minute she brandishes a box expectantly at me. It's a Clairol box. And just for one heady white-hot moment, I think, we're rebranding Clairol. I'm going to help rebrand Clairol. Oh, my God! This is massive! Until reality hits. Demeter doesn't look excited, like someone about to redesign an international brand. She looks bored and a bit impatient. And now her words are impinging properly on my brain. My roots are a different matter. I look more closely at the box. Clairol Nice and Easy Root Touch-Up. Dark brown. Restores roots colour in 10 minutes. You want me to... You're such an angel. Demeter flashes me one of her magical smiles. This is my only window in the whole day. You don't mind if I send some emails while you do it? You'd better put on some protective gloves. Oh, and don't get any stuff on the carpet. Maybe find an old towel or something. Her roots. The special, perfect project is doing her roots. I feel like the wave has dumped on me. I'm soaked, bedraggled, seaweed-strewn, a total loser. Let's face it, she didn't even come out of her office looking especially for me. Does she actually properly know who I am? As I head back out, wondering where on earth I'm going to find an old towel, Liz looks up from her screen with interest. What was that about? Oh, I say and rub my nose, playing for time. I can't bear to give away my disappointment. I feel so dumb. How could I have ever thought she'd ask me to rebrand Clairol? She wants me to do her roots. I try to sound casual. Do her roots? Echoes Liz. What? Dye them? Are you serious? That's outrageous, chimes in Rosa. That is not in your job description. Heads are popping up all around the office, and I can feel a wave of general sympathy, pity, even. I shrug. It's okay. This is worse than the corset dress, says Liz significantly. I've heard about the whole team once trying to zip Demeter into a corset dress that was too small, but she wouldn't admit it. In the end, they had to use a coat hanger and brute strength. But clearly roots are a step down even from that. You can refuse, you know, says Rosa, who is the most militant person in the office. But even she doesn't sound convinced. The truth is, when you're the most junior member of staff in a competitive industry like this, you basically do anything. She knows it, and I know it. It's no problem, I say as brightly as I can. I've always thought I'd be a good hairdresser, actually. It's my backup career. For that, I earn a big office laugh, and Rosa offers me one of her super expensive cookies from the baker on the corner. So, it's not all bad. And as I grab some paper towels from the ladies, I decide, I'll turn this into an opportunity. It's not exactly the one-to-one meeting I was after, but it's still a one-to-one, isn't it? Maybe this can be my wave, after all. But, oh God, blech. I now know hairdressing is not my backup career. Other people's scalps are vile, even Demeter's. As I start to paint on the gooey dye stuff, I'm trying to avert my gaze as much as possible. I don't want to see her pale, scalpy skin, or her little flecks of dandruff, or realize just how long it's been since she last did her roots. Which, actually, must be no time at all. There's hardly any grey there. She's clearly paranoid, which makes sense. Demeter is super aware of her age, and how we're all younger than her. But then, she totally overcompensates by knowing every internet joke before anyone else, every bit of celeb gossip, every new band, and everything. Demeter is the most on-the-case earliest adopter known to mankind. She has gadgets before anyone else. She has that must-have H&M designer item before anyone else. Other people camp outside all night to get it. Demeter just somehow has it. Or take restaurants. She's worked on some very big restaurant names in her time, so she has zillions of connections. As a result, she never goes to a restaurant except when it first opens, or, even better, when it's not open yet except to special important people like her. Then as soon as the general public is allowed in, or it gets a good review in the Times, she goes off it and says, "Well, it used to be all right, till it was ruined," and moves on to the next thing. So, she's intimidating. She can't be easily impressed. She always had a better weekend than anyone else. She always has a better holiday story than anyone else. If someone spots a celebrity in the street, she always went to school with them, or has a godchild going out with their brother or something. But today I'm not going to be intimidated. I'm going to make intelligent conversation, and then, when the time is right, I'll make my strategic move. I just have to decide exactly what that strategic move should be. "Okay," says Demeter, who is typing away at her monitor, totally ignoring me. "Fine," I say, dipping the brush again. "If I have one piece of advice for you girls, it's don't go grey. Such a bore." Although, she swivels briefly to face me, "your hair's so mousy. You wouldn't notice." "Oh," I say, nonplussed. "Good. How's Hannah doing, by the way? Poor thing. I hope I reassured her before." Demeter nods complacently and takes a sip of coffee, while I gape dumbly at the back of her head. That was an attempt to reassure Hannah. "Well, I don't know what to say. Yes, I think she's all right. Excellent." Demeter resumes typing with even more energy, while I lecture myself silently. "Come on, Katie. I mean, come on, Cat. Cat!" Here I am, in Demeter's office, just her and me. It's my chance. I'll show her the designs I've done for Wash Blue, I decide in a rush. Only I won't just plonk them on her desk. I'll be more subtle, make conversation first, bond with her. I glance for inspiration at Demeter's massive pinboard. I've only been in this office a few times, but I always look at the pinboard to see what's new. It's like Demeter's entire fabulous life, summed up in a collage of images and souvenirs and even fabric swatches. There are printed out designs for brands she's created, examples of unusual typefaces, photos of ceramics and mid-century modern furniture classics. There are press cuttings and photos of her at events. There are pictures of her family skiing and sailing and standing on picturesque beaches, all in photogenic clothes. They couldn't look more perfect. Her husband is apparently some super-brainy head of a think tank, and there he is, in black tie, standing next to her on a red carpet somewhere. He's holding her arm affectionately, looking appropriately gorgeous and intelligent. Demeter wouldn't settle for anything less. Should I ask about the children? No, too personal. As my eyes roam around, they take in all the piles of papers everywhere. This is yet another thing that drives Sarah mad. When Demeter asks her to print out emails, I often hear her muttering at her desk, "Read them on the fucking screen." On the shelf beside Demeter is a row of books on branding, marketing, and design. They're mostly standard titles, but there's one I haven't read, an old paperback entitled Our Vision, and I look at it more closely. "Is that book Our Vision good?" I ask. "Brilliant," replies Demeter, pausing briefly in her typing. "It's a series of conversations between designers from the 80s. Very inspiring." "Could I maybe borrow it?" I venture. "Sure." Demeter turns her head briefly, looking surprised. "Be my guest. Enjoy." As I take down the book, I notice a little box on the same shelf. It's one of Demeter's most famous triumphs, the Red Fern Raisin Box, with its dinky little red string handles. Everyone takes those string handles for granted now, but at the time, no one had ever thought of such a thing. "I've always wondered about red fern raisins," I say impulsively. "How did you get those string handles through?" It must be expensive. Oh, they're expensive, Demeter nods, still typing. It was a nightmare persuading the client.